As I think many of you know, there are many schools of Buddhism, many different traditions within the wide tradition of Buddhism. And sometimes it's been emphasized that all these traditions are kind of like the limbs of a tree, or all of them are equally important and equally beautiful. And what they have in common is the sap that runs through the tree. It supports the growth of the tree. And the sap that all these different Buddhist traditions have in common is considered to be the sap of awakening, the experience of liberation, a free heart, a free mind. And one of the ways of talking about this, one aspect of this sap of the tree of Buddhism, is the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening, sometimes called the seven wings of awakening, are one of the most common teachings in the early discourses of the Buddha. It seems that this was something that the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on, was focusing on developing and cultivating the seven factors of awakening. In some sense, the Buddha was more interested in having practitioners develop these seven factors of awakening within them than he was people developing, understanding certain beliefs or ideas or tenets of Buddhism. And that's one of the characteristics of Buddhism in general. It's much more interested in inner cultivation, in development and change, than it is in understanding of teachings in an abstract way. The seven factors of awakening is a list of seven, which should be good for many of you to memorize, just to have it in mind, easily at hand. And the seven factors are mindfulness, investigation, rapture, tranquility, mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And I'll go through them. Now, there are many different ways of, a number of different ways of talking about the seven factors of awakening. Sometimes they're emphasized that these will arise naturally in the course of mindfulness practice. You don't have to do anything particular to develop them. Mindfulness is not about trying to making any effort to change your state, but in bringing full presence to what's actually happening in the moment, a natural process begins to evolve on its own, and these seven factors become quite strong. Another way of talking about them is that the seven factors of awakening are developmental, that you develop mindfulness first, and then with the strength of your mindfulness, you cultivate investigation. With the strength of your investigation, it brings on the factor of energy. And the energy or engagement, the effort in practice, then brings on rapture. And the rapture sets the conditions for the rising of tranquility. Tranquility makes it a lot easier to develop concentration. And concentration supports the development of equanimity. So they're sequential. And that's the way I want to talk about them today, is that they're sequential in practice. So mindfulness is what our basic practice is here. Mindfulness is considered to be one of the innovative offerings of the Buddha, innovative discoveries of the Buddha in the spiritual quest. And mindfulness is a very simple but sometimes very elusive factor. We all have the ability to be mindful, to pay attention. And we're trying to cultivate and strengthen that ability to be mindful, to notice what's happening in the present moment. Mindfulness is a very simple in that mindfulness doesn't try to judge, doesn't try to manipulate or change what our experience is. It's the kind of the raw, basic recognition or cognition of what's happening in the present moment. If you listen, you hear the airplane. There's not much work that goes into cognizing the fact that there's a sound of an airplane above us. It's mindfulness that recognizes the sound of an airplane, that recognizes the sound of a puttering, whatever it is up there. And it's pretty easy for someone to encourage your mindfulness to be present. I just did it. I pointed out the sound, and I trust that 99% of you then turn your attention and listen to the airplane flying by. So your mindfulness was prompted by someone else. The question is, can you prompt your own mindfulness? And the mysterious and wonderful thing about mindfulness is that when you're not mindful, you can't. When you're not mindful, you're mindless. Maybe that's not quite right. When you're not mindful, the mind is, you know, it's like teenagers when the parents have left home. And it's time for a party. So, but it's kind of a mystery, you know, how do you get yourself to be mindful? Because if you try to make yourself mindful, you're already mindful. But if you're not mindful at all, if you don't have any presence of mind at all, then you don't have enough presence of mind to even want to be mindful. So, you know, what do you do then? What you do is you recognize the fact when you're mindful that you're mindful, and then when you find yourself in a mindful state, then you try to promote it, you try to strengthen it, you try to sustain it. It's kind of a mystery of when we find ourselves to be mindful. Now, what happens to many people is their mind wanders off, like in meditation, and they're not mindful. But there's no problem because they're not present enough to know that. So that's fine. At some point, they wake up and they realize, my mind's been drifting, or I'm lost in my thoughts, or I was lost in my thoughts, or I'm preoccupied. In that first moment of recognition, there is mindfulness operating. And the initial moment of recognition of that perhaps is very akin to what it was like when you listened to the airplane. It was kind of effortless, a very simple, matter-of-fact kind of recognition. What happens to many of us is that immediately is followed by a judgment or an attitude or a determination we start doing something on top of that mindfulness. We recognize, oh, I was lost. We don't take a moment to notice, well, now I'm no longer lost. Now I'm mindful. We berate ourselves for having been lost. And we say, it's really important for me to be mindful. I'm going to really try to be mindful now. Not noticing the fact that at that moment you were. And so sometimes there's a lot of judgment. Oh, I blew it. I'm a terrible meditator. I'll never manage this. But you just managed it. For a moment, you were mindful. Or sometimes people notice that they haven't been mindful for a while. They have enough mindfulness to notice that. And then they kind of have this pouncing attitude. And they're like, I'm going to pounce on my breath. I'm going to really, you know, do this well now. And so there's great determination. We pounce, you know, and we strike out with our mindfulness. If you do it more subtly, if you pay a little more kind of careful attention to appreciate that the moment you notice that you've been lost, the moment you notice you've come back, you're already mindful. That is a moment of mindfulness. In a sense, you can celebrate that moment, you can appreciate that moment. And in appreciating it, that's one of the ways in which we begin to develop it and sustain it and make it a more regular part of us. So what I'm suggesting here is that when you sit yourself down to be mindful, and you find yourself mindful, that's actually a very simple thing. And when your mind wanders away and you come back to the present moment and notice that what's going on, see if you can appreciate the simplicity of that coming back. And rather than trying to gear yourself up to kind of now do better, simply see if you can sustain the simplicity and the appreciation of that so you can keep going. So mindfulness is a little bit of a mystery. How do you promote it for yourself? And I'm repeating myself, but I want to emphasize that you promote it mostly by when it's present. You want to appreciate it and nurture it and cultivate it and try to continue it when it's there. All of us will find moments when it's there. It's not such a foreign thing for us to be mindful. Then can we sustain it? So mindfulness is a very simple factor of simply recognizing or knowing what's happening while things are happening. When you're thinking, we know that we're thinking. When we're having a feeling, we know we're having a feeling. When we're having an itch, we know we're having an itch. When we're having a judgment, we know we're having a judgment. When we're hearing a sound, we know that we're hearing a sound. We recognize a sound as something we hear. This is a phenomenally simple thing. And some people, because it's so simple, maybe won't give it much importance. Sometimes it's the most simplest things are the most valuable. And this is certainly the case with mindfulness. It's a very, very simple factor that we often overlook because we're so concerned about the objects of attention. Our awareness knows things. We can see this beautiful bell, and it's nice to have a big, big, beautiful bell. But there can also be the desire for the bell. And we can be engaged, preoccupied about the bell, wanting it. Or maybe the particular zafu we're sitting on doesn't feel very good today. So you can eat now. Some of you are probably either preoccupied about how do you get rid of yours, or how do you trade it, or how do you get to Bill first. So the mind has these interests in things it doesn't want or things it wants, objects. And so often we get lost in the objects of attention. But mindfulness is not about the objects of attention. Mindfulness is about the power to know where the mind is. Oh, now my mind is desiring a new zafu. The recognizing of that. And the recognizing of it is a very simple affair. And coming back to that simplicity is very, very healing. It's very, very powerful. It's a gift to be simple, they say around here. In the Quakers. Now, some people, when they teach mindfulness, or some people when they practice mindfulness, will simply advocate coming back to this ability to be mindful, and just be mindful choicelessly of whatever arises. And just not try to manipulate or change or have any particular focus to your mindfulness, but just simply develop and strengthen this luminous ability to be aware, kind of 360 degrees, panoramically, all around, whatever is arising. There's another school of practice which is a little bit different than that. And that rather than just being open kind of choicelessly to everything freely, it's actually, once you establish yourself in the present moment and have some semblance of stable mindfulness, then you use that mindfulness to investigate particular areas of your experience, particular domains of your inner life. And the second factor of awakening is investigation, but it's often referred to as investigation of mental states. And we use our mindfulness to begin investigating what are the mental states, what's the state of consciousness that's present for you while you're being mindful. So there's a particular interest to begin investigating these states of mind. Is the mind filled with desire? Is desire a mental state that's present? Is there aversion? Is there confusion? Is there fear? Is there worry? Is there joy? Is there contentment? Is there love? Is there compassion? There's a whole range of mental states that pass through our minds. And while there's many, many lists of the kind of mental states we can be attentive to, in the Buddhist tradition, they tend to be divided into two general categories. Those which are wholesome and those which are unwholesome. They're sometimes said to be those which are skillful and those are unskillful. The unskillful ones are the ones that drain our energy, that bring suffering to us, that constrict us and tighten us. The kind of mental states that arise based on greed, hate, and delusion are unskillful. They have negative effects on us. They drain our energy. They disperse us. They fragment our minds, our hearts. They tend to create habits of continuous future furthering of greed and hate and delusion. And it's possible to investigate these states, unwholesome states, and feel what it's like to have a mind which is filled with desire, greed, or clinging, a mind which is filled with fear, aversion. And you can feel, when you start investigating that, you feel the unpleasantness of it, how they're suffering in these states. When we investigate mental states, we also start recognizing the pleasantness of the wholesome mental states, the skillful ones. When we're content, when we're peaceful, when we're filled with love, when we're investigating itself is a wholesome mental state. When we're mindful, mindfulness itself is a wholesome mental state. We start recognizing actually what's going on for us in the moment as a mental state, as a quality, as a texture of the mind, as a quality of the mind, quality of our consciousness. And this is very useful because in that many of us are concerned about the objects of attention, we often don't notice the cost that our preoccupation has. If we're concerned about wanting something, clinging preoccupied with our craving, we don't notice that craving itself is unpleasant and is kind of causing a drain for us, sapping our energy. If we're involved in hate, and we're so caught up with the object of hate or anger, we might not notice the personal cost of being in that state. But if we notice a state of mind that's present, oh, there's anger present, what's that like, and we investigate it, you'll see that there's a tremendous cost on these unwholesome states. I've known people who have explored their anger in a way they've never noticed before and come to the conclusion that it's not worth being angry because it's causing greater harm to themselves than the person they're angry with. Some people say that you do your enemy a favor by being angry at them. You kind of doing their bidding by causing yourself suffering. So, mindfulness in itself, in and of itself, does not judge the different states of minds that arise. It simply notices what's there. And for some people, that's a phenomenal training in itself, is to not to judge our experience. And mindfulness training can be very helpful in this, is to learn how to notice different aspects of our experience. Notice when we're impatient. And do so without judgment. Do so without automatically kind of push it away or repress it. Or if there's a wholesome state of mind, not automatically judge it positively or try to hold on to it or try to show it off to your friends so that everybody notices that you're a generous person or something. So mindfulness simply recognizes these mental states. Now, recognizing our mental states gives us a tremendous amount of information, knowledge. It gives us a kind of a leverage to start noticing, as I said earlier, the cost of our experience and also the consequences of the different ways in which our mind operates. The consequence of unwholesome states of mind are unfortunate, are harmful. The consequence of wholesome states of mind, in and of themselves, when they're done purely, are beneficial for ourselves. And so, you know, as you go around, you notice even the subtle desires and aversions, are they worth it? You know, I'm thinking now of buying a new car. And so it's kind of natural or kind of automatic for many of us to, in that kind of state, to kind of look around and kind of, you know, start noticing cars. And I'm proving not to be a very good person at trying to buy cars because when I notice that there's this kind of desire clinging arising for a car, I lose interest right away with the it's not worth it. I don't want to go around with a state of mind that's kind of that contracted and clinging about, oh, I'd like that to have that car. So it actually promotes the peacefulness of my mind, the well-being of my mind. It doesn't help me get a car. But I'd rather have a peaceful mind than to have a car. And if it really becomes necessary, there are other motivations for getting a car than desire. So we establish mindfulness, and mindfulness is used to investigate the states of the mind that are present. And states of the mind are kind of like the filter through which we experience the world. State of mind is not like one like little factor kind of tucked away in the back of the mind. It's kind of like the state of, it kind of perfumes or colors the whole awareness and consciousness. It establishes the mood of consciousness. So that when we're filled with anger or hate, you better not make any decisions when you're in that mood, because your perceptions of the world are being filtered through that mood, through that state of consciousness. So the state, we're talking here about the state of consciousness. We started the filter, the lens by which we see our experience. So maybe you can see why it's important to bring our attention to it. So the next factor of awakening is that of energy, of effort or engagement. One of the things we notice when we investigate the mental factors is that certain mental factors, involvement with certain mental factors, are draining to us. They drain our energy. If you spend the whole day being stressed about desiring certain things or trying to avoid certain things or hating certain things or trying to cling to many things at once, and people who are very busy multitasking, so you can get exhausted by the end of the day. It drains our energy. Other states of mind bring us energy. If we spend time being joyful and happy, peaceful, it tends to regenerate many of us. And many of us will often regenerate ourselves by going to situations that bring us better states of mind. So we notice that when we are involved with certain things, it affects our energy. It affects our clarity and our alertness. It's also possible. So we started with this very broad mindfulness, and then we use the mindfulness to narrow the focus on the states of mind. And then we continue that narrowing, in a sense, concentrating of the attention, to see how are we engaged in this state of mind? Are we involved in it? We don't want to criticize or make anything go away in and of itself, but are we engaged in our unwholesome state? Are we engaged in more desire and getting lost in desire? Are we engaged? Are we involved in getting involved? Are we participating in this? Or are we not? And in narrowing the focus of practice then, we then turn our attention towards letting go of the involvement with unwholesome states of mind. It doesn't mean pushing them away or forcing them away or making them go away. It means we no longer get involved in them. So I desire a car. I see the cost of that desire. And I say, well, it's fine to have that desire pop up, but next time it pops up, I'm not going to be involved in it. And I want to follow that train of thought because it's tiring for my poor mind. If there's a wholesome state of mind that arises, then the instructions is to promote it. Stay involved with that. It's okay to be involved in that. If your mind gets filled with loving kindness towards someone, that's okay. That maybe has beneficial consequences. And stay involved in that. Don't try to disinvolve yourself from states of loving kindness. Stay involved. That's a wholesome thing to do. If you find yourself with a factor of generosity, sustain that. Don't let go of that involvement. If you're involved with an activity that brings you contentment or peace, stay involved with that. There's a formulaic way of which the Buddha talked about energy or engagement or in this factor of awakening. He said, disengage yourself with any unwholesome state of mind which has arisen, and prevent the arising of unwholesome states of mind which have not yet arisen. So if they've already arisen, stop your involvement. He didn't say exactly get rid of them, just stop your involvement. And if they haven't arisen yet, do what you can to avoid them arising in the future. Then he said, for wholesome states that have arisen, maintain your involvement with them. And for wholesome states which have not yet arisen, see what you can do to promote or encourage their arising. So this is a different flavor of mindfulness than the choiceless awareness kind of mindfulness. Both of them are equally valid way of practicing. But this is a way in which you actually use your mindfulness then to actually do a small subtle change in your inner activity. And that subtle change is you're no longer going to participate in unwholesome activities of the mind. You're going to let go of the involvement. It doesn't mean a judgment. It doesn't mean a pushing away or aversion. It certainly doesn't mean a repression of that. There's lots of permission for those stuff to arise with great compassion and generosity. But we're not going to stay involved. We're not going to participate. We're not going to get engaged. We're not going to pick it up necessarily. But when there are wholesome states that have arisen, then it's fine to pick those up. It's fine to be involved with those in this way of practicing. Now, one of the things that happens when you start taking some responsibility for where your mind is involved, what your mind is involved in, it begins freeing up a lot of energy. Or say it a little bit differently, that when we have some choice, when we apply choice to where the mind goes, then we tend not to put the mind in those places that drain the mind or drain the system of energy. And that, in a sense, frees up a lot of energy. And it frees up a lot of energy for the wholesome states of mind, but also just frees up a lot of energy in and of itself. And maybe you had the experience of sitting in meditation for 40 minutes or something. And I have this experience often if I sit in the late afternoon, that the first 20 minutes, I'm often quite tired. But slowly, my energy starts to kind of shift and change. And in the last 20 minutes, I start feeling quite alert and awake. It's like my energy is getting aligned and balanced and being reawoken and and no longer being drained in all the different ways I can think about wanting a car or whatever it is that's involved in. And this arising of this healthy, kind of balanced, aligned energy tends to bring some experience of joy or delight to the system. To be alert and energetic and present is joyful, is delightful. When that experience is quite strong, it's rapturous, which is the fourth factor of awakening, the experience of joy and delight. Rapture or delight is a wholesome mental factor. And one of the things we can do then is to promote that, is to appreciate that. The appreciation of wholesome mental states is one of the ways of promoting their continuation. It's one of the ways to make them a more regular part of our lives. So in one aspect of Buddhist spirituality is to appreciate the wholesome states of mind when they arise. And all seven factors of awakening are wholesome states of mind. So we appreciate our mindfulness when it's present. We appreciate our ability to investigate when it's present. We appreciate our energy, our good energy, when it's present. We appreciate joy and delight when it's present. So there can be this kind of freeing up of energy, this freeing up of delight as we do the practice. As we continue with the mindfulness and investigation, that energy tends to become more subtle or more tranquil or more harmonious in feeling. Some people have described it as if once the floodgates have been opened of good, healthy energy, at first all this energy kind of gushes out with great force, and you can feel a lot of rapture sometimes. But after a while, it tends to the water levels tend to balance on either side of the dam, and the water starts flowing much more smoothly and easily. And so this is the energy, the rapture then moves into an experience of tranquility, of calmness, of being settled. Not being in conflict with oneself, not being struggling, but rather being at ease, being settled, being calm. As the practice continues, that calm or that tranquility becomes a support for getting further concentrated. In this practice, where in this description of the practice I'm giving tonight, where it's much more engaged and willful and more focused, we want to actually do things to develop certain qualities. And at a certain point, one of the qualities we want to develop is concentration. And it's a lot easier to develop concentration when we've sorted through all our states of mind and have some ability not to stay engaged with the unwholesome ones, to free ourselves from involvement with this unwholesome states of mind. The five classic unwholesome states of mind that get in the way of concentration is desire, aversion, sloth, anxiety, and doubt. So we use our mindfulness to investigate the states of the mind. We learn to identify very carefully when desire, aversion, sloth, anxiety, and doubt are present. We learn what it's like to disengage ourselves from them, not being involved with them, not believing them, which frees up the energy, which tends to bring the ability to get increasingly concentrated. The five hindrances are with the forces which keep us distracted. So it's very important in mindfulness to recognize these mental states, the five hindrances. And the greater our ability to recognize it, the greater our ability to disengage from it. And the greater ability to stay disengaged from the five mental hindrances, the easier it is to get concentrated. And we want to get very concentrated when we do this kind of more directed practice. We want to get very settled in our concentration so that it isn't just simply a focus of mind, but a whole mood of concentration, a whole physical state of absorption. So there's a whole state that it's kind of like all our different faculties get integrated together and are functioning for the same purpose. For many of us, our many faculties are often quite dispersed and fragmented. We could have the desire to stay present with our breathing, but our fear is concerned about what happened at work today. And our desires are concerned about what's happening in the future with our vacation. But to bring all our faculties, our body, our emotional faculties, our feelings, our intentions, all together is what is involved in samadhi, developing concentration in Buddhism. So concentration is also a mental factor. It's also an embodied factor. It's kind of... But one of the things we want to do is to start recognizing when there's concentration present and appreciating that and kind of nudging it along, encouraging it, staying involved with it. Notice what it takes. Notice what factors come into play when the mind is settled and concentrated. To become kind of a connoisseur, kind of like a... When the mind gets a little bit concentrated, to begin appreciating what that state is actually like. Then we come back, in a sense, to the factor of investigation. To investigate, what does this feel like, this concentration? What are some of the different elements of it? What happens to my mind, my mental state, when I'm concentrated? Does it get sharp, alert? Does it get lighter, buoyant? Does it get feeling of being pervasive or open, radiant? What happens to the body as you get concentrated? Are there sensations of joy or delight, lightness or tingling in different parts of your body? Is there a feeling of wholeness or contentment in the body that tends to arise? Start noticing and appreciating these things, because it's the appreciation of the different aspects of concentration that will make it a lot easier to strengthen that concentration. It's kind of like a biofeedback system where you're kind of feeding everything back into that concentration. As we get more concentrated and more focused and more integrated, that becomes support for one of the most pristine or the most beautiful, one of the most, pristine is a good word, pristine of all mental factors, mental states. And that's the factor of equanimity. Now, when many people hear that about the equanimity that comes out of Buddhist practice, when they first hear about it, it doesn't sound like it's very important. Well, it's nice to be equanimous, to go around being kind of balanced in life. But, you know, really, I'm not that interested in it because I really enjoy the great ups. And, you know, if I go with the ups, maybe I have to kind of, you know, accept the downs. But ups and downs seem to be part of life. And this being kind of even, you know, like a Norwegian, is not so interesting. So, I'm Norwegian. But equanimity is not just simply kind of a bland evenness. Equanimity is actually a very strong, powerful, delightful mental state in itself. It's probably one of the most pristine or delightful or pure or clean. Maybe it's the cleanest mental state you can have. It feels so clean, so pure, so. And it's a little bit difficult for me to describe it, equanimity. It's often described as being a state that is balanced, where the mind, but it's not so much that state is mind is balanced and even. There is a kind of evenness to it. But it's more like the mind is completely, I call it sometimes a Teflon mind. That no matter what arises in the mind, there can be anger, there can be joy, there can be all kinds of states can arise. But there's no hooks in the mind for that. It just, nothing sticks to the mind. So it's really smooth, it's really clean. You know, the mind stays clean like a Teflon frying pan. So there's a wonderful ability, the mind has this wonderful ability to let anything at all arise in the mind. And there's no stickiness to it all. And this is a beautiful, beautiful state of mind, a state of equanimity. When the mind is equanimous, it's possible to have a lot of strong physical pain in the practice. And the physical pain won't bother you one bit. When the equanimity gets extremely strong, then there tends to be no physical pain at all. So these seven factors of awakening are the seven factors that come into play when we do mindfulness practice. For the people who do mindfulness practice choicelessly, without any kind of special direction and attempt to do anything, just strengthening mindfulness more and more and more mindful, the seven factors of awakening will mature on their own. But it's also possible to do this more directed practice, which I'm referring to today as being kind of a focusing. We start with a very open mindfulness, and once we've established an ability to be mindful, we focus it on the mental factors, the mental states. As we establish it on the mental states, investigate them, get to know them really well. Really well. It means when unwholesome states of mind arise, you say, great, I get to investigate it. You don't have to despair anymore. You say, great, I can be the world-class expert. I can get an Olympic gold medal in fear by really getting to know it well. Great. That brings some joy, you know. And it's actually quite wonderful. Many of us are oppressed by our mental states. Oh, not that again. But when you have mindfulness, you have this tool. You have something wonderful you can do about it. You can study it. You can investigate it. Great. So mindfulness gets focused on investigation. Investigation then, with time, gets focused on a very particular area, investigating how we get involved or not involved, how we're engaged and not engaged in the states that have arisen. That focus tends to become more narrow than on the energy, on the engagement. And that tends to bring joy and delight. And then we can study that joy, we can focus on it, and let that joy and delight equalize itself, or let the joy and delight kind of settle itself, or soothe itself into kind of a happiness and tranquility. That tranquility then becomes a fantastic, we really appreciate that and kind of go with that, a great springboard for then really beginning to integrate many of our different factors into this single focus of concentration. And when the mind is singly focused on concentration, when integrated in that way, the mind tends to become increasingly equanimous. That's the expression, right? Equanimous. In mature mindfulness practice, these seven factors become quite strong. And these seven factors also coexist, and they get balanced with each other. And when these are when they're quite beautifully balanced, and the mind is able to stay in a very equanimous state, then the mind itself is not going to be involved anymore with clinging. Clinging is you know, equanimity. There's no clinging in equanimity. And the greater the equanimity of the mind is, the less clinging there is. And when the seven factors of awakening become fully mature, and equanimity factor is fully mature, there's no longer any clinging at all in the mind. And when there's no more clinging at all in the mind, that provides the mind with a fantastic opportunity. And that opportunity is to let go of everything. And when the mind has the ability, not just the ability, but actually does that, lets go of every possible thing that the mind could hold on to, every last remnant of self-preoccupation, every last remnant of wanting anything or averting anything, then this amazing thing, transformation, happens in the mind, where the mind gets set free, the mind drops away, the mind itself is released. And a released mind kind of like disappears. And then it comes back. And then we go, wow, that was amazing. Now I know for sure the degree to which the mind, the normal states of mind, has clinging as part of it, and that it's really possible for a human being to release themselves from all clinging, that the mind can free itself from every last remnant of holding. And seeing that as a possibility, knowing that as a possibility, shows us that it's really possible to uproot suffering from our lives. And when suffering is uprooted from our lives, then happiness will be a much more familiar companion as we go along our lives. So I hope that this particular way of talking about the seven factors of awakening is useful for some of you, interesting. And for those of you for whom it's not interesting, I ask you to just leave the Dharma talk here tonight and go home without it. Thank you.